allies in the South China Sea.
Thank you for that, Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal. Mike Billington, thank you. Asia editor of the Executive Intelligence Review from Hamilton, Virginia. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran says the Iraqi government is responsible to prevent threats against Iran from the Kurdistan region and the view of the two countries' excellent ties. Defying international outcry, Israel says it will not cooperate with any external probe into the killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. And the EU top diplomat says that the bloc has provided Ukraine with over $8 billion worth of weapons and military equipment since the war with Russia started. Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran says Iraq's federal government has a responsibility to prevent any threats coming from the Arab country's northern Kurdistan region. Iranian foreign minister says Tehran and Baghdad enjoy excellent relations, and so Tehran does not expect to be threatened from the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Hossein Amir Abdullahian added the security of the two neighbors can be guaranteed if they abide by the outcome of bilateral talks. He made the remarks in a phone call with the Iraqi foreign minister. For his part, Fuad Hussein gave assurances that Baghdad will not allow any threats to come to its neighbors from Iraqi soil. Earlier, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps carried out fresh drone and missile strikes against terrorist bases in Iraq's Kurdistan. The force says the strikes are in response to the terrorist operations against Iran. Earlier, political commentator Issam Mahdi Torabi joined us with his take on the IRGC's operations in northern Iraq.
As you said, it's not the first time, and it probably won't be the last time that it happened. The problem is that we have, within the Kurdish areas in northern Iraq, a particular group, a family, which from previous years, from decades before, has very close relations with the Mossad, with the Israelis, and with the Americans. So the point is that that region is not uniformly supporting this problem. There are other groups and other parties and other movements within that area which are opposed to the presence of the terrorists. But there is one particular group and one particular family who, from long time ago, has been a group that has allowed the presence of the Americans, the Israelis, the British before, to be in that region. And from that region, this is something that goes back to the British division of the area. They created an area in the middle between Iran, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, from where they can always destabilize these countries.
EU affairs, foreign affairs ministers have agreed in new sanctions against Iranian individuals and entities during a meeting in Brussels on Monday. Jerome Hughes has your report from the Belgian capital.
Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims, but it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically a very strong position because they can decide, OK, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because the JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tehran has slammed the French President Emmanuel Macron for his recent meeting with a number of anti-Iran figures. A foreign ministry spokesman said the meeting was a violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. He called on Macron's praise for notorious anti-Iran activists shameful.
On Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron held a meeting with a number of U.S.-based anti-Iran figures at the Élysée. Among them, Masih Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. In the meeting, Macron described the recent riots in Iran as a revolution. Tehran strongly condemned the meeting, with the foreign ministry slamming it as a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani said it's surprising that the president of a country that advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. Western media tried to portray Masih Alinejad as an activist. Reviewing Alinejad's social media posts, one would notice that much of her online activity revolves around the campaign through which she calls on her followers inside Iran to go on the streets, do something to provoke a reaction, record it, and then send the video file to her for online posting. She calls the campaign My Camera is My Weapon, a campaign hoping to achieve polarization, confrontation, and hatred in Iranian society. She's on the U.S. government payroll. Between 2015 and 2022, the U.S. Agency for Global Media paid Ahlinejad over $628,000 to use her show to push Iranian women into challenging Iranian laws, while also demanding more sanctions against her country. She has been living in the U.S. for the past decade, working as a full-timer for Voice of America Persian, a media outlet directly funded by the U.S. government, made to capitalize on harmful narratives in favor of Washington's interests. It is interesting but not surprising to see Ahlinejad being hosted in Élysée Palace by French President Macron, who supported a law in his own country to criminalize the filming and dissemination of images showing the face or other identifying characteristics of a member of the National Police, the so-called Global Security Law, with imprisonment of up to 1 year and a fine of up to 45,000 euros for the offenders. The meeting with Macron was not the first of its kind. In 2019, Ahlinejad met Mike Pompeo, then U.S. Secretary of State, a hawkish politician with this mindset.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
In 2018, Ahlinejad also joyfully met Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, whose hawkish mindset saw the U.S. sanctions killing of 500,000 Iraqi children as a price worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice. But the price, we think the price is worth it.
Albright died earlier this year, but the brutal imperialist mindset is still alive and kicking, with the likes of Ahlinejad advocating for more economic terrorism.
And the anti-Iran figure stated that they had called on the French president to recall the country's ambassador, expel Iranian diplomats, halt sanctions removal talks, and impose new sanctions on Iran. Organizer of this meeting was a group called the Justice for Kurds, which has a special focus on Kurdish separatist elements in Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Turkey.
The organizer of the meeting between Ahlinejad and Macron is the New York-based Justice for Kurds group. The co-founders of this organization are Thomas S. Kaplan and Bernard Henry Levy. In Justice for Kurds, they are pursuing the goal of forming the state of Kurdistan, which is the result of the division of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Levy and Kaplan are both linked to the American hawkish group United Against Nuclear Iran, which pressured pharmaceutical firms to stop selling drugs to Iran amid a massive coronavirus outbreak in the country. Levy is a member, while Kaplan is one of the main funders of the group. Levy and Kaplan have lobbied for the interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE to sanction Iran. Also, in 2019, a report revealed that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates had paid over $35 million to the UANI and its sister organization, the Counter-Extremism Project, over 2 years. In addition to Kaplan, Sheldon Adelson is one of the top donors to UANI. Reports show that Kaplan and Adelson accounted for over three-quarters of the group's total revenue for 2013. The UANI is one of the organizations that Tehran imposed sanctions on in late October for committing human rights violations, interfering in Iran's internal affairs, instigating violence and riots in the country, encouraging acts of terror, countering Tehran's moves and attempts to fight terrorism, and mounting pressure on the Iranian nation amounting to economic terrorism.
Now, Israel says that it will not cooperate with an external probe into the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The Israeli Minister for Military Affairs made the remarks after reports emerged the FBI has launched an investigation into the killing of the Palestinian-American reporter. Benny Gantz said the inquiry mounts interference in Israel's internal affairs and is a serious mistake. Abu Akleh was fatally shot by Israeli forces while covering a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin in May. Her killing sparked international outrage and calls for justice. The Israeli military initially denied responsibility for her killing, but later admitted that one of its troops had probably shot her. Investigations by the UN and several news organizations have concluded that that the journalist was deliberately targeted by Israeli troops. The EU top diplomat has hailed the bloc's military assistance to Ukraine in its war with Russia, while claiming that Moscow has failed in its military efforts. After a meeting of EU foreign ministers, Joseph Borrell said the bloc will continue to isolate Russia globally by imposing sanctions in order to cripple the Russian economy. He also claimed the Russian President Vladimir Putin is unable to defeat the Ukrainian army and is withdrawing his troops to compensate for what Borrell called military failures. The EU foreign policy chief also accused Putin of deliberately increasing human suffering in Ukraine. Borrell further gave some figures for the European Union's aid to Ukraine since start of the war in late February.
And I think I can say that at least 8 billions of military equipment have already been provided to Ukraine by the European Union and the member states. It's about 45% of the effort done by the US. So it's not negligible. We are talking about not 3.1, but about 8 billions on military support.
Canada has also announced it's doubling its military aid to Ukraine to over 1 billion Canadian dollars. Funds go toward military surveillance, communications equipment, fuel, and medical supplies. Canada has also sanctioned the Russian justice and security officials, accusing them of human rights violations against opposition leaders. In response, Russia has added 100 Canadians to its sanctions list. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky has addressed the summit of the world's top 20 economies, calling for an end to what he calls Russia's destructive war. Zelensky accused Russia of weaponizing energy ahead of winter and undermining energy price stability that is across the world. He said this should be countered by imposing a price cap on Russian oil exports. The Ukrainian president also accused Russia of nuclear blackmail in the Ukraine war, despite repeated denials by Moscow. Zelensky was speaking via video call at the G20 summit in the Indonesian city of Bali. The opening speech to the summit on Tuesday, the Indonesian president called for unity as well as measures to stop the world from heading to another world war. Widodo, who chairs the G20 summit, hoped leaders of the bloc can find a way out of the global economic woes despite disagreements over the Ukraine war. Summit is being held without the presence of the Russian President Vladimir Putin because of the war. Issue was a key topic at the event where participants condemned Russia's war in their draft declaration. Hundreds of medical workers take to the streets in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, to protest against low salaries and poor working conditions.
I feel sad. The truth is that they take away our vocation because we can no longer work like this and live like this with an undignified job. We have a great vocation. We do it non-stop for the patients. We love public health, but people have to know because they will always go to the hospital. No matter what coverage they have, they will always need the hospital.
Doctors and nurses held candles and carried banners that read, "Healthcare does not switch off." Protest comes almost 3 weeks after health workers began a push for an increase in their minimum wage, among other demands. A freeze in wages and rampant inflation has put pressure on staff in 30 public hospitals throughout Buenos Aires. Inflation is forecast to log a 100% surge this year in Argentina. In Australia, hundreds of people have been rescued after flash floods hit several towns in the country's southeast. Rescuers have used helicopters to save people trapped on the rooftops in the worst hit towns in the state of New South Wales. Residents scrambled to rooftops to flee the floods caused by heavy downpours in recent days. Water has inundated homes, highways, bridges, and farms, and isolated many towns. Despite the halt in raining, emergency crews are warning the danger is yet to pass. Over the past year, Australia's east coast has been repeatedly struck with severe floods driven by La Nina phenomenon, which brings heavy rains. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence. in the limelight.
$8 trillion in U.S. taxpayer money has been given to U.S. defense contractors over the last 20 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "The four corporations are representatives of the modern-day piracy, that is, the U.S. war industry, a corporate capture of U.S. foreign policy, the Congress, the Departments of Defense and State, and the U.S. economic system. What is it like to be so ashamed of the company for whom you work that you cannot bring yourself to admit you work there? Ashamed of the products they manufacture, the innocent people those products kill, the hundreds of billions of dollars of public taxpayer money squandered in a gluttonous pursuit of profits. This is life as seen on November 10th, 2022, as Raytheon Technologies in Arlington, VA, members and supporters of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, a public tribunal, served subpoenas on four United States weapons manufacturers, charging them with war crimes, crimes against humanity, theft, and bribery. The other three corporations served that same day were Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and General Atomics. These four corporations are representatives of modern-day piracy, that is, the U.S. war industry, a corporate capture of U.S. foreign policy, the Congress, the Departments of Defense and State, and the U.S. economic system." Raytheon Technologies occupies a towering office building in Arlington, a stone's throw from the Pentagon and Arlington National Cemetery, two sites commemorating death and the utter failure of war. Though the Raytheon building has its corporate logo plastered in blood-red letters at the top, once inside, no sign exists evidencing this corporate war profiteer. No name, no logo, no recipient. A sad attempt to hide their dealings in the black art of war. When asked, security guards refused to acknowledge Raytheon was in the building. Of the dozens of employees who passed, none would admit they worked at Raytheon, averting their eyes as they hurried away. When police arrived to escort the tribunal members and supporters off premises, the police would not acknowledge Raytheon was headquartered there. Just like the employees, they had their orders. Keep quiet, admit nothing. It was silent as a tomb except for the voices of the tribunal members speaking the truth about the trail of suffering and death Raytheon and his corporate brethren have left across Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Somalia, and the Palestinian-occupied territory. Meanwhile, these merchants of death have left the United States financially, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. Raytheon Technologies has a market capitalization of $96 billion. According to Macro Trends, Raytheon Technologies' revenue for the quarter ending September 30, 2022 was $16.951 billion, a 4.55% increase year over year. For 2021, it was $64.388 billion, a 13.79% increase from 2020. For 2022 was $56.587 billion, a 24.78% increase from 2019. And for 2019 was $45.349 billion, a 30.68% increase from 2018. In 4 years, they have garnered almost a 70% increase in revenue. Marketing death is good for profits. If you can live with yourself, Apparently, given their silence, many Raytheon employees struggle with this very issue. Raytheon builds some of the most destabilizing, destructive, and expensive weapons on Earth. The hypersonic missile, which travels in excess of 5 times the speed of sound, Mach 5, covering vast distances in minutes. It is hard to stop and flies nimbly to avoid detection and dodge defensive countermeasures. All these are attributes which make the missile so destabilizing to a foreign leader who has only minutes to determine whether they are being attacked with a nuclear weapon. Raytheon makes the Peregrine air-to-air missile, which they claim increases firepower, penetrates bad weather, and goes the distance. Add to that their plans to use high-power microwaves in war, and we see the epitome of a merchant of death. Boeing, General Atomics, and Lockheed Martin are the same. They, too, revel in blood money as they build for war and drain the U.S. economy. In fact, some $8 trillion in U.S. taxpayer money has been given to U.S. defense contractors over the last 20 years. The U.S. war industry plays a key role in fomenting war with their congressional lobbying, not just pushing for weapons contracts, but influencing military strategy, thereby exacerbating and prolonging the anguish of civilians bearing the brunt of these wars of choice. On the issue of war in particular, Congress must be answerable to its citizens, not a handful of corporations. With their silence on November 10th, these weapons manufacturers revealed their shame. Their corporate mission statement is war begets profit. For the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, the mission statement is come war profiteers, give account, stand before a tribunal and be judged. And so, what is it like to give your talents to a corporation which hides its very existence? To give all your efforts and education and experience in the creation of weapons which kill indiscriminately? Their loss of words, their averting eyes, the damning silence offered in their corporate crypt is the devastating answer. Meanwhile, the website of Hill wrote, "The first order of business for the post-midterm elections lame duck session of Congress should be an agreement on a budget framework and passage of fiscal year 2023 appropriations bills. This critical task should be done before Congress adjourns at the end of the year. Most importantly, it must be completed prior to December 16th deadline of the current continuing resolution. Under this CR, the Defense Department is losing up to $207 million in buying power per day. The new Congress should not have to start its session with urgent old business hanging over its head and increasing damage to national security. Defense needs at least $824 billion in fiscal year 2023 to mitigate inflation, modernize, and support the force. And the process of reaching a budget agreement will unfortunately likely include discussions again about defense, non-defense budget parity, a better understanding of what is in the defense budget. The largest single piece of discretionary spending can help. This country has always and will always debate how to appropriately spend taxpayer dollars. It should, but what does and should guide thinking about federal priorities? The Declaration of Independence asserts that the first duty of government is security as it lays out self-evident truths, including unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We'll be right back. Today, the lack of defense budget transparency is particularly harmful given the politics of U.S. government funding overall. As national policymakers continue to insist on budget agreements that mandate parity between defense and non-defense accounts in discretionary spending, appropriations other than entitlements and government debt service, they're looking at an inaccurate picture of that balance from the start.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's program, we'll be focusing on the shocking story of how the democratically elected president of the National Union of Students, Shaima Dalali, was ousted before she'd even taken office. And we'll be examining the pivotal role played by the Zionist movement in securing her removal. I'll be talking to experts to find out more after this report by Latifa Abouchakra into the background of how the president of the National Union of Students was targeted.
Shaima Dalali was elected to the post of president of the UK National Union of Students in March 2022. Now it has been announced that she has been sacked before she could even take office. Dalali tweeted, "On the first day of Islamophobia Awareness Month, I find out I have been dismissed through Twitter." The sacking of Dalali is the culmination of a massive campaign of smears, intimidation and bullying by the Zionist movement. The National Union of Students has been under sustained pressure from the Zionist movement and its assets since March this year when she was elected. Students at 23 universities wrote a joint statement denouncing the smear campaign and the harassment of Shaima after she was wrongfully accused of anti-Semitism. But the NUS buckled early on. The Zionist Union of Jewish Students stated, "We call on Shaima and her team to ensure that NUS becomes a space Jewish students once more feel welcomed into, rather than sidelined and excluded." Accepting the dishonest statements of the UJS, the National Union of Students apologized, saying it was so sorry to particularly Jewish students who have been hurt and that they sought to ensure Jewish students feel welcome in our spaces. But Zionist students will never feel welcome or included in anti-racist spaces, since Zionism is an intrinsically racist ideology. This compromise with racism set in train the inevitable process of removing the democratically elected president of the NUS. An independent investigation was announced to be led by Rebecca Tuck, QC. The NUS board stated it worked closely with the Union of Jewish Students to make the appointment and to agree the terms of reference. In other words, the Zionists were able to vet both the terms of the investigation and the person appointed to conduct it. The terms themselves were prejudicially written to express the fabricated anti-Semitism witch hunt. The appointed QC was inevitably predisposed to finding against Dalali because she's a Zionist. Her public statements reveal that she has a clear and partisan opinion on the issue of anti-Semitism in universities. Before making her Twitter account private following her appointment, Tuck shared a Times article on May 23, 2021, titled, "I'm an English student. It's not my job as a Jew to answer for Israel over Gaza." Tuck wrote that she was shocked and saddened by the university experience of the children I've watched grow up in my community as proud Jews, now hiding their identities. In June 2021, Tuck co-authored an article titled "Anti-Semitism in the Workplace," which defended the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's Zionist-friendly definition, which equates targeting of Israel as a nation with anti-Semitism. The next step for Dalali is to fight back against these decisions with a legal and political challenge.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Ibrahim Abul Esed. Ibrahim is a UK-based Palestinian researcher and activist. He obtained his master's degree in Middle East Studies from Leiden University, specialising in the formation of Palestine since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Ibrahim was the first writer to expose the conflicts of interest of the lawyer who undertook the investigation into Shoma Dalali for the National Union of Students. Welcome to the show. David, tell us about this tweet that Shoma posted when she was just 17 years old that she subsequently apologised for.
Well, this has been held to be the clear evidence that she's an anti-Semite. And of course, she was 17 years old when she did it. But it refers to a battle or a siege, actually, back in the year 628, so quite a long time ago, in which some Jewish villages and towns were besieged by a Muslim army. And they came to an agreement that they would stop the siege on the payment of a proceeding of tax in the future. There was no massacre. This is an entirely invented thing by the Zionists. And, of course, the reason that they invent this massacre is because they want it to fit into the narrative that there has always, from time immemorial, been anti-Semitism. It's always the same. It comes from every society where the Jews are. And that's why we need to fight anti-Semitism. That's why we need to see anti-Semitism in the really broad way in which they see it. Of course, that's not the case. Anti-Semitism, racism against the Jews, has specific causes in specific historical periods, and it's different in specific historical periods. So there's an attempt to construct this monster of anti-Semitism, which doesn't actually really exist in today's society.
And tell us about the implication of safe spaces, so-called, in this case.
Well, again, this is the problem. The Zionists want to say you shouldn't be blurring together Zionists and Jews. You shouldn't be blaming Jews for what the Zionists do. And we say, well, we don't do that. No. But it's them who consistently does do that. And so they have this idea that Zionists should be the beneficiary of safe spaces. You shouldn't be targeted for having the particular views that they have. And if they are targeted in that way, that's a form of anti-Semitism. But of course, being a Zionist is a political set of beliefs. It's not a protected characteristic. It's not being black or white or a man or a woman. And of course, there should be no safe space for Zionists. Zionism is a form of racism. And you know, and the idea that we have safe spaces for racists is, of course, the very opposite of what safe spaces is supposed to do.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the absurdity of that. I mean, I think if people think back to the South African apartheid regime, if people were saying we want a safe space for apologists for the apartheid regime there, I think they'd have been laughed out of court, wouldn't they? But Ibrahim, let me turn to you. I mean, is it fair to say that this Rebecca Tuck has a conflict of interest then?
Well, Chris, as the video clearly showed, Rebecca Tuck has expressed her position on this topic through her online social media activity, sharing the articles written by the Times that alluded to the fact that any form of Palestinian activism on British campuses equates to anti-Semitism, which is absurd. People calling for the human rights of an oppressed people does not automatically equate to anti-Semitism. Rebecca Tuck has also, within that tweet, mentioned the words shocked and saddened, so it obviously shows that she has a clear position on this topic, which is not needed. We need to ensure that there's independence and integrity when the investigation has been conducted. She had also co-written an article titled Anti-Semitism in the Workplace, where she had made references to the IHRA's definition on anti-Semitism, stating that targeting Israel is anti-Semitic, which, again, is an absurd assumption to make. Mm. Calling for the human rights belonging to the Palestinian people and aiming to hold Israel accountable. Israel, which, again, was referred to as an apartheid state by international human rights organisations as well as Israeli human rights organisations. Mm. It is not anti-Semitic to call for the human rights belonging to an oppressed people.
Sure. I mean, David, this Rebecca took, I mean, what she said something about the Jewish labour movement, hasn't she? Well, tell us a bit about that.
Well, how do you know that? You don't know that. It's very difficult to find out because, of course, her Twitter account is now private. She set it to private after she was appointed to this role. Sure. But, of course, some people have got the ability to do due diligence, and we know that back in the day she was a supporter of the JLM's appointment to the Labour Party for anti-Semitism training. Now, of course, that's completely absurd. The JLM is a Zionist organisation committed to Zionism, and it's being brought in to do anti-Semitism training, which, of course, would be a definition of anti-Semitism, which blurs together Zionism and anti-Semitism. So there's a clear indication there from her stuff that she's put out that she is party pre. She's already, before she started this, biased against the whole idea that it might be possible to dispassionately examine this. So that there's, you know, the whole investigation as a result, you know, not even accounting for the fact that it was that her appointment and the terms of reference were vetted by the Union of Jewish Students, again, another Zionist organisation. I mean, it would be laughed out of court anywhere else, but because it's to do with anti-Semitism, everyone just pretends it's not happened.
Mm. Ibrahim, how do you think people should respond to smear campaigns like this?
I believe you should join groups or organisations that will be able to defend you, be part of a collective as opposed to an individual, and understand that being part as a collective, you stand stronger as opposed to being an individual, being targeted by organisations that are very coordinated, very uniformed in their attacks and against their campaigns and smear campaigns. So I would definitely advocate to those that have been experienced like Shema to join such collective organisations that mirror you as an individual and your outlook on particular topics when it comes to Palestinian activism, when it comes to your mistreatment as a woman of colour, as a woman with a headscarf on your head. Definitely join a collective as opposed to standing there as an individual being targeted by such campaigns.
Mm. And David, I mean, how is it that the IHRA described the targeting of Israel, inverted commas, as anti-Semitic?
Well, people have said, one of the things that they say about it is that many of the examples attached to the IHRA working definition, which itself is only about 30 words or so, are examples which mention Israel in some way. So there's already a presumption that that's something to do with anti-Semitism. But there's a specific thing in there which talks about the Jewish people's right to self-determination. And if you question that, that is itself anti-Semitic. Now, what they're talking about here is the right of a Jewish state, meaning a Jewish majority state, which which is in practice is based on the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. So, if you criticise that, you're in some way denying a fundamental right of the Jewish people to ethnically cleanse and colonise Palestine, which of course is absurd. And it's that distinction, they transfer the idea of anti-Semitism from individual Jews to the state of Israel, which is at the heart of this problem with the IHRA. Mm. You can't have a nation state which has rights above every other nation state, which is what they're asking for.
Yeah. I mean, how did the IHRA come about in the first place, David, very briefly?
Well, there's a long period, 20 years, as many of them will say, that to get there. And it came out of a process which was started off by the Israeli government, in which Mossad was in charge. They then created this various forums for the discussion of this, the Global Forum for Combating Anti-Semitism, and that they then used that to get the EU to adopt the working definition. The EU eventually rejected it, and so they had to find somewhere else for it to go, and that's how it ended up in 2016 at the IHRA, and it became the weapon of choice for this entire period for attacking the left and politically active Muslims.
Right, OK. Well, let's just pause there for a moment, because we're going to have a short report on the capture of the National Union of Students by Zionist lobby groups.
The National Union of Students has been colonised by the Zionist movement. How did this happen? As usual in these harassment campaigns, there were a variety of extremist Zionist groups in operation. The original Kompromat appears to have emerged from a troll group called Labour Against Antisemitism, which specializes in fake charges of antisemitism. This was a group of ragtag activists responsible, as the Labour file revealed, for 12% of all complaints on antisemitism to the Labour Party.
12% came from the organization Labour Against Antisemitism.
One of its key figures, Ewan Phillips, who is not Jewish, made complaints to the party using a false Jewish-sounding name.
Labour Against Antisemitism is a collective of party activists. It regularly makes accusations against Jewish party members. But its spokesman, Ewan Phillips, is not Jewish. The Labour files show that Phillips writes to the party's disputes unit using a pseudonym that appears Jewish.
Also central to the attacks on Shaima Dalali has been the Union of Jewish Students. It's now increasingly known that the UJS is not, as it claims, there to represent all Jewish students. Rather, it is constitutionally bound only to represent Zionist students. As a Zionist organization, it is represented on and helps to run the World Union of Jewish Students, which is a direct member of the World Zionist Organization based in occupied Palestine. In 2002, WJS produced a Hasbara, or propaganda handbook, subtitled Promoting Israel on Campus, which was sponsored by the Jewish Agency for Israel, one of Israel's national institutions. The handbook aimed to arm pro-Israel Jewish students with tools for influencing public, political, and campus opinion on Israel and Zionism. Among other things, students were told that when it is not possible to level the charge of antisemitism, it is often worth expressing personal upset, saying that one was hurt as a Jew by the controversial act. The language of hurt was adopted from the beginning by the National Union of Students. This indicates that they had already been indoctrinated by heavy Zionist pressure and intimidation. The idea that Jewish students are hurt by criticism of Zionism is a dishonest camouflage for political disagreement. It is not legitimate to feel or claim to feel hurt by opposition to the racism of Zionism. Imagine if supporters of the far right said they were hurt as a white person at criticism of the neo-fascist beliefs or identities. People would rightly laugh. As with all such attacks, the response should be militant and principled. No apology for anti-Zionism. The response should be at a political level to confront the racist ideology of Zionism in all its forms.
Ibrahim, do you think the NUS has been captured by the Zionist lobby?
Well, in order to answer that question, we must speak of the UJS and their connections to the NUS. The UJS, the Union of Jewish Students, has been found in the past to organise trips where they invite NUS members to stay in illegal settlements that are on stolen land. It has also been found that the UJS, through the Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, has a productive working relationship with the Israeli embassy. It was recorded that the UJS former president, Nina Friedman, was speaking so proudly how there are UJS alumni in the IDF, UJS alumni in the foreign ministry to the president's office. So we see a clear connection between the UJS and the State of Israel. But now what is the UJS's involvement with the NUS despite organising these trips, these annual trips towards Israel? As David mentioned earlier, the UJS were involved in the selection of Rebecca Tucker when conducting the investigation on Shema. So we definitely see a clear connection between the NUS, to the UJS, to the State of Israel. And it's an umbilical cord connection that must be severed, and as long as that connection stays, we will see more individuals like Shema as well as the many before her, being silenced, smeared and targeted by the Zionist movement.
Sure. David, I mean, what do you make of the role of the Labour Against Anti-Semitism group in the witch hunt?
Well, Labour Against Anti-Semitism was a key group which was involved in targeting the Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party. It made something like 12% of all the complaints to the Labour Party, and many, if not all, of these were effectively fake and fabricated campaigns. They would dig up compromat from people's old Twitter accounts or their Facebook, which they'd left open, the privileges open, etc. And it's an organisation which, as you saw in the film there, the guy, Ewan Phillips, one of the leaders of this organisation, was writing letters to the Labour Party complaining about people using a fake Jewish-sounding name. I mean, it's an incredible state of affairs. Now, the Labour Party knew this, but didn't really effectively take any action against them. Now, they were the ones who dug up the compromat on Shema. Mm. You know, one of the tweets they found when she was 17, you know, they've argued is anti-Semitic. The rest of them are all clearly to do with Israel and to do with anti-Zionism. They might have been rude, they might have hurt people's feelings, you know, but they're not in any way racist. And it's an absurdity that they should investigate her on the basis of an organisation which is so discredited after its appearance in the Labour files, and it's used as if it's an honest witness and an honest broker in raising allegations against someone who has been, let's remember, democratically elected by all students who are able to vote in an NUS election.
Yes, indeed. And Ibrahim, I mean, what do you make of the claim by the Union of Jewish Students then that it's representative of all Jewish students?
Well, that is clearly a lie. You have Jewish students as well as Jewish academics criticising the UJS. Mm. Specifically, you had, in relation to Seamus' case, Barnaby Rain speak out and criticise the UJS for uploading a petition whereby his signature had been forged. So it is silly to believe that Jewish students that aim to campaign for the Palestinian rights and Palestinian freedom as well as their dignity feel represented by the UJS that clearly have a direct connection to the State of Israel, that clearly wants to colonise more and more Palestinian land. As we see with the most recent election, Ben-Gavir stated it is time for us to be the landlords of our own country. Mm. So we see that connection. So it's absurd to believe that the UJS represents all Jewish students, as there are Jewish students that speak out against Israel's occupation in Palestine.
I mean, and how is the UJS connected to the World Union of Jewish Students? Well,
the UJS is a board member of the World Union of Jewish Students, as well as the World Union of Jewish Students is a member of the World Zionist Organization, as the video showed. We also see ex-presidents of the UJS taking up jobs for the UJS. So there is the direct connection there when it comes down to the appointment of the individuals, to their perceived outlook on the situation in Palestine, everything from the ideology to the individuals that propagate that ideology.
Mm. And David, I mean, tell us about this Hasbara handbook. I mean, does it really say that students should claim to be hurt as Jews?
Yes, and the interesting thing about this, it's quite clever, really. I mean, this is from 2002, and they say that, you know, when you can't be sure if something's anti-Semitic, or if you haven't got the evidence that it's anti-Semitic, but what you should do is you should say you're hurt by the comments, but you're not just hurt and upset as an individual, you're hurt as a Jew by the comments. So, of course, the clear implication there is that although you might say something which is actual, you might be hurt as a Jew, the implication is that you're saying this is something which I feel is anti-Semitic, but I'm not actually accusing you of anti-Semitism. Mm, mm. And it encourages this idea that anti-Semitism is everywhere, that it's widespread. And, of course, it's not. I mean, this is the whole problem, is the creation of the idea of hurt, where your political feelings are hurt, as if that's something to do with racism. It's not.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's the Hasbara handbook. But, Ibrahim, the National Union of Students are using the language of hurt. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's ridiculous because, quite frankly, if you were to say to me, Chris, Ibrahim, I have felt hurt by the actions that you have done, I would not want to repeat that whatsoever. It is a very specific word, using it to silence any individual that wants to campaign for the dignity, human rights, belonging to people that have been oppressed, facing Israeli occupation for over 70-plus years. Again, if you said to me, Chris Ibrahim, I felt offended by what you said and it has hurt me, I would not want to repeat that. But now we have to ask ourselves the question, why is an individual feeling hurt for me advocating for another person's freedom?
Mm. I mean, given all of that, David, and, you know, what we've heard, I mean, What do you say to this notion that some argue that there should be no apologies? You know, we shouldn't apologise. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, no apology will ever be enough. The Zionists will never accept an apology and say, OK, maybe you made a mistake. Let's get on. Let's have our different political views, but let's get on. Because they don't want you to get on with them. They want to defeat the opposition to Zionism. That's the problem. The problem here is Zionism. Zionism is a form of racism, and as a result, as with other forms of racism, it needs to be demolished and dismantled. That means not just defeating the ideas, but dismantling all of the organisations which give Zionism and the racism which is intrinsic to it sustenance. So that's every single Zionist organisation, yes, in occupied Palestine, but also in the UK, in the US, in France and elsewhere. In the UK, there are literally hundreds of Zionist organisations, and many of them have charitable recognition. Mm. These are organisations which are there, which perform as part of their key roles, promoting racism in Palestine, and also actually promoting racism against Muslims and Palestinians in this country too.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've spoken on this show, haven't we, before, about how anti-Semitism is weaponised, but also apologies. I think there's examples, aren't there, of apologies being weaponised as well.
That's right. I mean, the mistake which the Labour Party under Corbyn made, and some of Corbyn's closest advisers, very closest advisers, including people who have been on what's called the far left, were advocating that what we should do is apologise and move on. The news cycle moves on, people will forget. But, of course, they didn't calculate in the fact that the Zionists don't forget. This is an organised political movement with a massive institutional support structure, which is able to keep this on the agenda day after day, week after week, month after month. And so you can't apologise and move on.
OK, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. So that's it for today's show. I hope you found the programme informative. Thanks to our guest, Ibrahim Abul Ased, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.